Hello, everyone. It's Dave Chen. Quick note about this episode. Joanna and I actually were only able to record the first hour of this episode, which covers the season finale of season 3 of Game of Thrones. Due to scheduling conflicts, we were actually unable to complete the recording as we had planned. We will be doing that later in the week. Rather than wait for that, though, I kind of just wanted to get this first hour out for you guys. So apologies for the slight schedule change, but here is the first half of our episode covering Season 3, Episode 10 of Game of Thrones. It will end abruptly, and there will be a follow-up episode coming later this week. Enjoy. Hello, everyone, and welcome to A Cast of Kings, an unofficial podcast about the HBO original series Game of Thrones. My name is David Chen, and I've never read any of the books in George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
My name's Joanna Robinson. I've read every book in George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
And welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. I mean that sincerely because we have a lot of new listeners this week. There was a huge response in the podcasting world, in the blogging world, in the television critic world, to last week's Red Wedding episode of Game of Thrones, entitled The Reigns of Castamere. Interesting statistic, General Robinson. There was one download of A Cast of Kings for every 100 viewers of that episode when it aired. So that is how many people downloaded A Cast of Kings last week. People really needed an outlet for their grief. And that's understandable, because I certainly did as well, and this podcast was that for me. So if you're tuning in for the first time, thank you guys for tuning in. If you don't know how things work around here, we treat Game of Thrones primarily as a television show, not as a book series. So that means we'll be spoiling everything through this week's episode of Game of Thrones, Season 3, Episode 10, the season finale, Mysa. We will not be spoiling anything from future week's episodes, and that includes anything in the next time on previews of Game of Thrones that they show on HBO, anything in terms of plot developments from future books. Basically, if you need to ask, is it a spoiler if dot dot dot, it is probably a spoiler. So please do not mention it in the comments or in emails, lest they be screened by Joanna Robinson. Speaking of emails, you can always email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. That's acastofkings@gmail.com. Find more of our episodes at gameofthronespodcast.com. Couple of announcements. We always like to do corrections at the beginning of each episode, talk about some corrections that we made. In response to errors that we made at the end of the last episode. And a lot of people commenting on my mispronunciation of Walder Frey. Did I do it right just now, Joanna? Right?
Perfect.
Walder Frey. And it's just so I will say that listeners get points because they pointed out that I was wildly inconsistent in my pronunciation. And at least if I'm going to be wrong, I should be consistent about it. But that being said, he is a fictional character. And I don't – unless there was pronunciation guides in the book, Joanna Robinson – my guess is the matter of how to truly and correctly pronounce Walder Frey's name may not have been settled unequivocally yet, right?
So that's creative.
Maybe
I
was the one that was pronouncing it correctly and you guys had it wrong the whole time. Think about that, okay? That's all I'd encourage you to do is think about that.
That was like some Sixth Sense twist at the end of
there
that.
There you go. That M. Night Shyamalan style twist is that I had Walter Frey's name pronounced correctly the whole time. And the other thing I wanted to point out is just that this episode might be a little bit shorter than usual, but fear not, there are more episodes of A Cast of Kings on the way. We have a bonus episode coming up with one of our Kickstarter backers, so you can look forward to that. And I believe either separately or combined with that episode, we're going to be discussing feedback to this season of Game of Thrones and also to this episode of the podcast and of the show. So don't worry, this is not the last you'll hear of us. But I do want to point out that if you want to keep in touch with us and see what comes next for A Cast of Kings, there's a few ways to do that. First of all, the best way is going to our Facebook page. Go to facebook.com/acastofkings. That's facebook.com/acastofkings and join our community there, our non-spoiler community. at facebook.com/acastofkings. You can also follow me and Joanna at on Twitter at twitter.com/DaveChensky. That's Dave Chen, S-K-Y. And Joanna, where can people follow you?
Twitter.com/QuitYourJRob.
Follow us on Twitter, and we'll give you guys updates about what's going on. But yeah, I think following the Facebook page is probably best because there's kind of a bit of a community there now. And when we, you know, when we figure out how best to extend this podcast into the off season, you know, you can look to that page to see the details. So, Facebook.com/acastofkings, or follow us on Twitter. We'll have more updates for you in terms of what's next for A Cast of Kings. I will say that probably for season four, assuming Joanna and I are still alive and on speaking terms, we'll probably try to do a Kickstarter for season four of Game of Thrones as well. So you can look forward to that. And you'll find out about that at the websites that I just mentioned on Facebook and Twitter. And also, of course, on the Cast of Kings podcast feed. So that's just kind of announcements for today. And before we begin today's episode, Joanna Robinson, I just want to say, like, it has been quite a gratifying adventure and journey to do this podcast with you this season and to kind of see the Cast of Kings community grow dramatically over the course of the season. It's just been very enjoyable and also very emotional. I don't know what your experience has been.
Now I'm emotional. I wasn't prepared for this. But Dave and I both agree that it's really sad that this show is only 10 weeks out of the year, not just because it's fun to watch, but we're really sad that this is only like a flash in the pan project that we get to do. So we'd both like to do it, I don't know about all year round, but at least a little longer. So I love working with you, Dave, and I love our little community that's built up. So yeah it is emotional. Now I'm really upset.
it's been pretty great, guys, and a lot of fun. And so we'll have more to say about this at the end of this week's episode, but just wanted to make sure that was out there before we begin. So obviously a lot of response to the Red Wedding episode. Let's get to that later on in this podcast, Joanna Robinson. Let's just get to this episode. Okay, season 3, episode 10, season finale. A lot of anticipation, right? Because you knew that whatever happened after last week's episode, it was probably going to be a big come down, right? I did not know that the come down would be quite this big, but we'll get to that. We'll get to that. So this episode picks up right where the last one left off, and it appears to be moments after the events of the last episode, right? Where Roose Bolton kind of ascends to the roof and he looks out over the camp where Rob's men are being slaughtered. It's actually a really gorgeous shot, and I thought done well. Like, it did not look like it was CG people. It looked like it was, it almost looked like they did some compositing of real life and CG. I don't know if it could have been all CG, but it was just a really gorgeous shot. And we kind of see the aftermath of what happens. The Hound has Arya, and she wakes up just in time to see her brother's corpse paraded about with the direwolf's head on top of his neck. Go ahead.
See, this is my this is my question, I guess, for the listeners. And because you weren't quite clear on what was happening in that scene, right?
No, but that's true of most of the scenes in the show. So
No. I'm not saying that, but like, I don't know how clear it was that was Rob's body for people who weren't expecting it.
No, I got that. I got that it was Rob's body.
Oh, didn't get that it was his direwolf's head.
That was not clear to me initially. Although I believe it became clear later on in the episode when the Roose Bolton's men are kind of describing, or Frey Walder then. Frey's men are describing how difficult it was to sew that thing on.
Right. Like a crafting lesson that they give us a little later on.
That's right. It reminded me of the hood scene from Django Unchained, if you guys have seen that movie.
So
you're like, oh, that's a lot of detail there for out of nowhere.
The mouth holes. Right. Okay. Well, okay. As long as...
Yeah, so I picked up on that.
Understood. I picked up on that. A gruesome act. They sewed his beloved pet and companion's head on his body because he was called, you know, the young wolf. And so it's very upsetting. It's upsetting that Arya sees it. And Maisie Williams' face, you know, as she looks, it was chilling. And I wasn't sure they were going to do it. Like, it was so gruesome that I was like, is HBO really going to do this? And they did it in a good way where it's sort of like, it was enough in the background and there were torches, you know what I mean? So it was just sort of like...
It did not come off as very gruesome. It came off as
like
a very...
shadow puppet show, but like it could have been really nasty. So
yeah, it came off as distasteful, let's say.
Yeah.
It came off as them defiling his corpse and not necessarily as something that was beyond the pale. And the direwolf's name is Greywind, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So mm-hmm. Arya is very saddened, and it's pretty you know, shocking to see that happen. Interesting though, just like there's not that many episodes that I can recall where the events of the next episode are right where the previous episode ended, right? Like there was season one with Baelor, right, and then the episode after Baelor. It's like right after Ned's head is cut off. But most episodes kind of, there is some kind of shift in time. And so, I did appreciate just being able to grasp some of the aftermath of what was going on here. So then we go to King's Landing, and I got to say, this is probably my favorite plot line of this, episode. Cause we, you know, King's Landing noticeably absent from last episode. We don't know what's going on with Tyrion or Sansa or Tywin or Joffrey. And
find out.
Yeah, and so Sansa and Tyrion have this nice little delightful chat in the garden, and Tyrion kind of takes a page out of Arya's book by reciting the names of the people that mocked him, and you know they're probably in for something bad in the future. And they have this great little moment where she kind of is scheming with him about what to do to those guys, and by sewing sheep dung into their beds, and you kind of think like, hey, like over time this could probably be a relationship that worked out in some way,
like at least a friendship or something. And I loved that part where she, you know, he's like, why do you call it sheep shift? And she's like, well, shift is the vulgar term for dung. And it's like, oh no, it's not, Sansa. Dummy.
I didn't get that. Like, did she just mishear it the whole time? Or
yeah, either she misheard it or Arya misheard it or whatever. But like, yeah, that they misheard shift for shit. So
nice.
Yeah, and she thought she was being so naughty when she said it. Like her little face lit up. Anyway, it's pretty cute.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of people actually pointed out, I don't know if we actually got to these emails, Joanna Robinson, but a lot of people were talking about how, two episodes ago when Tyrion married Sansa and Sansa said something like, what if I am never okay with you coming into my bed, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, and you and I, Joanna, had not interpreted Tyrion as being significantly emotionally damaged by that statement. But a lot of people saw hurt on Tyrion's face. And so we should point out that is some context going into this episode, that Tyrion probably has a thing for Sansa and is a little bit bummed, you know, that she, right on their wedding night, is like, hey, it's probably not going to work out. Of course, Tyrion has a thing for a few ladies, as we'll discuss later in this episode. So you kind of see this friendship start to blossom, maybe. And so, hey, things are looking up, which we know how that ends up in the Game of Thrones world.
Everything's coming up, Sansa.
Yeah, that's right. Or Tyrion, however you want to put it. So then Tyrion is called to the small council. And this has got to be the highlight of the whole episode. Right?
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Like, Joffrey, in his delightful glee. And like Tyrion had this kind of meta moment where he's like, he says, you know, did you kill a bunch of puppies or something along those lines? Like,
yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
He basically stating what the audience is thinking. And they have this really tense conversation where Tyrion essentially threatens Joffrey, right? And that is just not something cool that you do. We've seen Joffrey not take too kindly to that in the past. And essentially, you have this kid, this sociopathic kid running around, and everyone, all these adults around the table are trying to placate him in different ways, right? So in any case, let me just get to the plot point, which is that Joffrey is excited that Robb is dead and
gleeful, delighted.
Wants to serve Robb's head on a plate to Sansa during his
wedding.
At his wedding.
Yeah.
To Marjorie, right?
Yeah. At Joffrey's wedding to Marjorie, he wants to serve Robb's head on a platter to Sansa.
Right.
Because that's what you do.
That's what you do when you're a gentleman and
yes.
a king. And, you know, it's funny, like, how Cersei tried to save Joffrey. He's like, oh, I'm sure he's just joking. And Joffrey's like, what?
No.
What are you talking about?
Right.
Very uncomfortable. And Joffrey has that line that made it into the trailer of Game of Thrones, which he says, everyone is mine to torment, which is pretty chilling when you think about the implications there. So what was obviously the high, I mean, there are so many fantastic, like, moment after moment in this scene was just fantastic, you know, paying off a lot of characterization that's happened throughout the season, paying off, like, Tyrion's impatience with Joffrey, Cersei's kind of hopelessness in terms of her, how she perceives Joffrey, and Tywin's, shall we say, condescension to Joffrey, right? Like, basically treating him like who he is, which is a grandson that doesn't really know what he's
throwing
doing.
Throwing a tantrum, right. Yeah. And this is where I ring, like, the same tired bell that I do every week, which is that this scene is the one that cleaves closest to the book. It's out of this episode, which veers so drastically from the book and weakly so, this is the highlight, because this is just, they were like, okay, that scene is awesome in the book, we'll just use it. And I mean, it's never wrong when they do. Well, maybe it sometimes is wrong. Anyway, this is great. It's a great scene. I loved it. I loved all the characterization in it. I love Charles Dance. His, like, when Tywin's just like, I'm done. It was fantastic.
Well, he says, anyone who says I am the king is no king, which
right.
There's kind of no follow-up to that. Like, what is Joffrey supposed to say in response to that? I got super uncomfortable during this scene.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because you have an unstable element, and you know that Tywin is really the most powerful person, but, it, you know, on a basic level, Joffrey can still order around the King's Guard and deliver orders to the army, and they'll still listen to him. Right. So
will they? Or if Tywin comes up and says, no, do this instead, would they do that?
Right. I mean, good point. Good point.
You know, and the point that Tywin makes is that, I mean, he says to Tyrion, you're a fool if you think, you know, he's the most powerful man, or that being a king is what makes you powerful. You're a fool if you think that. And then Tyrion's like, yeah, that's a good point. And then that's like the natural transition to Tyrion being like, I see what you did there with the Red Wedding, basically. Like, you're not, Rob was the king and look what you did to him. So.
Yeah, and actually a lot of people pointed this out about how, you know, the greater good, right? And how the Red Wedding, while incredibly gruesome and painful, probably saved lives. Do you know what I mean?
If you're doing a numbers game, ultimately.
If you're doing a numbers game, right, that even though they brutally murdered the Starks, that it probably saved tens of thousands of Northmen from perishing in battle. Now, what are those Northmen going to do now? It's not entirely clear yet, but there is some sort of logic that you can, if not respect, then at least understand.
But that's what echoes, what resonates later in the episode, which we'll get there with Davos and Stannis. It's that same question, the other side of the coin, though. So
right. I mean, he kind of is making almost like a. It reminded me of the justification for launching the nuclear bomb in Japan. Almost, I mean, I know the analogy is far from perfect, but this idea that you perpetrate this atrocity to
bring about peace.
Yeah, to bring about peace, quote unquote. Right.
Right.
And so that's kind of what he's trying to do. And Tyrion's kind of like, yeah, I admire what you did. And there's this. The only moment in three seasons, I think, this episode, when Tywin becomes emotional with Tyrion, right? And admits that he wanted to kill Tyrion as a baby, but decided not to because for the good of the family. And it was kind of moving. Now, you could bring up the possibility that Tywin is manipulating Tyrion, but I don't read the scene that way.
Well, right? That wasn't really my interpretation, that he was having like a tender, squishy moment with Tyrion. I felt like, I mean, obviously he wasn't, but I felt like it was more like, it's only because of my staunch feelings about family and duty and honor that I didn't drop you in the sea like I really wanted to. Like, it's only because I've got this very rigid sense of blood that I did that. And I really, really, really wanted to kill you. But you're a Lannister, so I've been doing my best with you. Like, it sounded shitty. It did not sound like emotional, you know?
Yeah, I guess you could interpret it either way, right?
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of emotional, like, I felt like he was getting emotional. I felt like he was saying he was – there's some anger there. But it was ultimately like, look, guy, like, I have made sacrifices as well.
Look, right? Pal. Yeah.
And I, you know, I think that gets across. You can see it, like, his voice is, like, shaking. He starts shaking a little bit when he's saying those lines. And we've never seen him behave like this in front of Tyrion. So I think he was reaching a place where he had never reached before when delivering this speech. And it was pretty powerful stuff.
When have you ever done something that wasn't in your interest, but solely for the benefit of the family?
The day that you were born. I wanted to carry you into the sea and let the waves wash you away. Instead, I let you live. And I brought you up as my son. Because you're a Lannister.
Tyrion goes back to Sansa and she's crying, so she's obviously heard the news.
I loved that scene. It was, you know, she had no lines. And she just turned her face and, like, the tears are dripping off her face. And it was like, and the way she was in shadow, I just thought that was so perfectly done without any dialogue necessary. So
let's bring up the rest of this scene as well, or the rest of this plot line, if we may, as well. So later on in this, in the episode, there's also a scene where Cersei and Tyrion kind of have a little heart to heart.
Right.
I remember their heart-to-heart. I think it was – I want to say it was season – I don't remember which season it was. But there was this – remember the one season episode where they – Cersei kind of like confesses stuff to him, stuff to Tyrion. And it's so awkward because Tyrion has no idea what to do, right? He tries to kind of take her hand or something, but it's just clearly like these people have hated each other for a long time. And so whenever Cersei and Tyrion try to have a heart-to-heart, it usually ends badly.
There was also that recent episode when they both found out about who they would have to marry. You know, they also had like a little conversation there where basically concluded like, we're both super fucked.
Yeah.
We don't know what we're going to do. So.
And this time I thought it ended pretty well. You know, I think they're coming to have more of an understanding for each other. Cersei kind of is honest with him and talks about how even though Joffrey is a psychopath, like she did derive some joy from the fact that he was her psychopath. Do you know?
It was another theme that was plucked out in this episode was that of parenthood. Like, you saw Catelyn Stark lose her son, Rob, and then die herself. And so I feel like this theme of parenthood gets plucked over and over and over again with Tywin, with Cersei, with Davos talking about his son. You know, it's just like everyone seemed to be reflecting on what it meant to be a parent. And, you know, even if your child is a monster, or even if you've lost a child, or even if you perceive your child to be a monster. So I just thought that was an interesting theme that they pulled out. And yeah, I really liked this scene between these two actors. Basically, I said it before, anytime you get a Lannister in a room with another Lannister, it's good. It's good television.
Good stuff. Good stuff. And so anyway, that's kind of the...
Well, then we also, the Shay and the Varys...
Right.
Is that at King's Landing?
Yeah, I guess that is. I actually was hoping we wouldn't have to talk about that.
Oh, okay, let's not talk about it.
No, let's talk about it. So then Shay and Varys have the scene. So you've seen Shay kind of following along, you know, following Tyrion because she's the handmaiden of Sansa this whole time. And Varys has a scene where he offers her money.
Right.
To go away.
Just get out.
Yeah. And... you know, we got an email from Bob from Michigan, which I thought was... I don't know if I agree completely with Bob from Michigan's email, but I do think it's worth reading. Bob writes, "I don't understand Shay. I think the biggest flaw with the character is a lack of consistency. One minute she's a whore, and the next she's sticking with Tyrion, even though it means she has to be a handmaiden, and then she's getting all warrior woman with Sansa, and then she's quoting marriage vows to Tyrion... and then she's being all high school jealous bitch about Sansa, even though Tyrion obviously has no choice. And then she's throwing a fortune away because she'd rather be with Tyrion. Does she love him or not? Would she stick around if he stopped paying? If no, why did she refuse Varys' money?" I don't think that Bob is reading this situation with Shay quite correctly. I do agree with Bob that the character is really annoying, but I don't think it's because she's necessarily inconsistent. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that she has a thing for Tyrion, right? That they clearly have this bond. And she's really annoyed that Tyrion won't forsake his vows and his obligations to his parents and to Sansa and just be with her. Right? Am I reading this correctly, Joanna Robinson? Right.
Well, I mean, that's your interpretation, and that's certainly a strong interpretation that you could get from watching the show. It's very different from who, like, she is a sort of more grasping, greedy person, I think, opportunistic person in the books. And so it's like they're trying to whitewash the story and make it more romantic, but it's not sticking. In my opinion, I actually agree with Bob. Like, I think the portrayal has been very inconsistent and the writing of Shay has been very inconsistent. And it's one of the biggest problems for me, like the biggest most problematic characters. Every Shay scene, I'm just like, ugh, really? So I don't know. That's my feeling.
Yeah. I mean, well, I'm definitely like, ugh, as well. I mean, Varys gives a very logical speech to Shay about how you're a complication, you're a distraction, and Tyrion is the only person that can really save this kingdom.
Were you really excited? Were you like, maybe Shay will go away?
I was actually super excited. I was like, oh my gosh, is this the end of Shay finally?
Yeah.
But nope. And so she comes off as, I think there's supposed to be this female empowerment moment when she kind of throws the bag back at Varys and says, no, I'm gonna do whatever this other guy tells me to do instead. Did you feel like it was supposed to be like an empowering scene?
Well, it was really confusing because she's like, if he wants me to leave, he can tell me himself. So was her interpretation that Varys was like, acting on the behalf of Tyrion? Or was she saying that, you know, the only person who can tell me to leave King's Landing is Tyrion, or I did not.
I think it was the latter.
The latter.
This is the only guy that can tell me to leave. In which case, you know.
I guess so. I don't know.
But where is the tension? Like, do we think? I don't think any of us. Does any of us actually want Shay to stay? Is the question, right?
Does Tyrion even want Shay to stay?
There is that great moment at the end where season two, where Shay kind of accepts Tyrion, even though he's disfigured and wants to stay in King's Landing,
right?
And I remember being quite emotional during that scene. But
now you're like, go away.
No, Shay. I mean, it's been 10 episodes since, it's been like a third of the whole series length since then.
Yeah.
And there's been nothing there that makes me think Shay is anything but quite an annoying character and somebody who will possibly lead to Tyrion's downfall, if not be a huge setback for whatever good he's trying to accomplish.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm hoping that she will go away, but I have a feeling with this scene, the show is saying, or the books are saying that she's here to stay. That remains to be seen, but yeah, I'm not a huge fan of this storyline. So,
agreed.
It sounds like you feel the same way.
Yeah.
Okay. So, what else do we got here in this episode?
Well, we have we have Bran and the Reeds and Hodor, and they go to Castle Black, and they talk a bit about the guest rights, which we talked on the show about last week. But we all kind of agreed that the show didn't really do a good job of explaining it in the Red Wedding episode. So I guess they kind of explained it here, how big of a violation it is to murder a guest. So right. They have that whole story with the rat cook.
And that was pretty well done. And they cut to Walder Frey right after that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So
in case you missed what we were talking about.
Right.
Here's Walder Frey. So,
right.
Yeah.
That they were that he was mean to his guests. This was kind of a weird scene with Walder Frey and Roose Bolton, right?
It was terrible. It was shoehorned in for exposition's sake, in my opinion.
So can you explain what exposition took place during this scene?
Well, we found out that Edmure didn't die, that he's in the dungeons. We found out that the Blackfish escaped. We found out that what Roose's motivations were, which is that he's been made the Warden of the North. We found out a little bit more about Walder's motivation, like how he felt so slighted by the Tullys and all this sort of stuff. And
Can you actually explain that a little bit more, the being slighted by the Tullys? I didn't quite grasp that.
Oh, well, he's just a very oversensitive man. But he was, he opens the scene by saying something about how, oh, they used to call me the late Walder Frey because, my troops didn't arrive to a battle on time. And, they never respected me. And they always, made fun of me for marrying young girls and all sort of stuff. He was just nursing these wounds that seemed so minor compared to, slaughtering everyone under your roof. So, I don't know.
Well, actually, we got a pretty great email, I thought, that really kind of changed the way I think of it. What are you laughing at?
Nothing. I don't know if it's the email I think I'm thinking of.
Well, the email that was basically talking about like what Walder Frey, like why he might have done what he did. Do you know what I mean? And how he kind of – how offering the twins passage to Rob was kind of him putting – you know, sticking his neck out there.
Oh, right? Oh, that – right. I see what you mean. It was like a strategic thing. How it was safe. How it was safer to ally himself with the Lannisters at this point because Rob was like bleeding Bannermen and stuff like that. Is that what you're talking about?
Right. I'm trying to find the email. There's a couple of emails here. Actually, Megan from Athens, Georgia writes in that, you know, the Red Wedding and the slaughtering of the unborn child was useful in showing the unintended consequences of vow breaking, even for the innocent. I'm not the biggest fan of Rob, and it really upset me when he decided to break faith of the phrase in order to marry Talisa. A ruler has bigger responsibilities than his own wishes, so yes, Walder Frey is horrible and ultimately responsible for her murder, but in a way her blood is on Rob's hands too. His ultimately selfish, if understandable, decision to put himself and his desire over his honor results in this tragedy. This scene helps underscore that decisions have consequences far beyond what is intended or thought of by those who make them. Like Catelyn's decision to free Jaime having this horrible domino effect, Rob's decision to betray the phrase and follow his heart results in the terrible events that he did not foresee. That's one email. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I mean, yes, but like if Walder Frey were to withdraw his support and withdraw his troops from Rob, we'd all be like, okay, yeah, you know, he was an oath breaker and Walder, you know, if Walder decided to give all his troops to the Lannisters, like that makes sense in the strategy of war and the question of honor. But to invite people into your house to play as if you're going to reconcile and then to callously murder people, I mean, that's a different.
I don't know. I think those are. This is basically different points on the spectrum, Joanna.
Okay. All right.
Imtiaz, I think that's how you pronounce it, wrote this in. Something I was thinking about over the last couple of days was Walder Frey's perspective in all this. Don't get me wrong. I think he's a scumbag. And let's just pause. I'm going to step out of this email for a second and say, yeah, he is definitely a scumbag. I mean, when you look at that episode, I've rewatched The Red Wedding a few times. And there's something really just chilling to the bone when Catelyn is about to slit Walder Frey's wife's throat, and Walder is just drinking wine like nothing's going on. Do you know what I'm talking about? He's just like, oh, this is just kind of a daily occurrence.
Then
for
he
me.
Can find another one. Yeah.
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 He says, okay, back to Imtia's email. This wasn't just revenge for the insult of not marrying his daughter. Rob's actions put the Freys in an awkward situation. They risked a lot in siding with the Starks, but now had no gain. With the Lannister seemingly winning and getting stronger, Walder was in a tricky situation. Tywin's reputation goes before him. They did not want to end up on the losing side with Tywin Lannister winning. They were ripe for turning. Also, a book difference to discuss. I just want to kind of address that. Stop that right there. And yeah, he kind of stuck his neck out, and now they're in a bad situation because Lannisters are like, well, you were almost going to join with Robb Stark, right? Now we have to kill you. So Walder Frey was like, I don't want that to happen, and maybe I'll join with you guys instead. And do you not think that's a plausible motivation?
No, it's a plausible motivation, but like I said, I can understand him becoming a turncoat and allying with the Lannisters. I don't understand orchestrating the Red Wedding. That's what makes him a monster, you know?
Sure. Okay.
Like, you know, no longer being allies with the Starks makes sense. Slaughtering them in a not like, and it's not even like ungentlemanly. It's just like, that's not, you violate the rules of war by doing this. That's what makes him one of the biggest villains.
He is very ungentlemanly, I think. We can definitely conclude he is very ungentlemanly.
All right.
Put that out there. Okay. So then what happens is that Sam and Gilly arrive, which, by the way, was kind of, whoa, because our storylines collide very rarely in this show.
Wait, right? No. Well, I think, are we not going to talk about Theon?
Oh, yeah. Okay. No, good point.
Well, just because it was a crazy cut, because Walder was sitting there eating and Roose was talking about his bastard, Ramsay. And he's talking about him, and then you cut back to more eating, and it's not, it wasn't clear for a second that it wasn't still Walder with the sausage. And then you cut up and you're like, oh, it's Ramsay. Oh, it's a penis joke. Like, okay. But anyway, I mean, the Ramsay Snow reveal.
Yeah,
was the other expositionary element was then we find out, you know, and then so Walder's like, so tell me, whatever happened at Winterfell? And then Roose Bolton goes, oh, this is what happened at Winterfell.
Okay, so let's explain exactly what happened, all right? So Theon and the other people from the Iron Islands took over Winterfell.
And right.
Was it the offer was made by, was it the Lannister? No, who is it? By Robb's men, right?
Right.
To,
of which Roose is, like, Roose sent his bastard as an emissary representing Robb Stark. And they offered amnesty to the Ironborn men if they gave up Theon, which they did. But then Ramsay took Theon sort of off the grid. I mean, he's at the Dreadfort, which is their keep. But, like, they didn't communicate with Robb that they had Theon. And
well, also,
until later.
I believe it's implied that the other Ironborn men were killed as well. Like, they were killed even though they had adhered to the terms.
That wouldn't surprise me. That wouldn't surprise me.
No, that I think he says something about, there's a word said about flaying those men, I believe.
Oh, wow.
So
that is their favorite thing to do.
Yes. Okay, so now it comes out that the things that we were talking about, like people were asking, what were you talking about last week, Dave, with the chess pieces, is that Roose Bolton's sigil is a flayed man upside down on the X, right?
Right. On St. Andrew's Cross, I think it's called.
Right, and a lot of people have been saying, oh, well, it's obvious. They've put it out throughout the entire season. It's, you know, in the scene with Jaime and Brienne. It's right there in between them. And it's like, okay, if I do maintain, if you're looking for it, it is there. And if you're not looking for it, it's not obvious, book readers. It is not obvious.
It's true. But everyone who now knows, when you go back and rewatch the season, you'll see the Bolton House banner flying in several scenes. And you'll be like, oh, okay. So for those of us who knew what to look for, it was there. And
also, Roose Bolton's sigil, he like wears a pin as well.
Right. But it's like black on black. So it's hard to tell. Anyway, the other thing is...
Which, by the way, is so gruesome. I mean, who in their right minds would wear, like, make their symbol of their whole house a freaking dude, a dude hanging on an X? Do you know what I mean?
Who would ally themselves with the house?
That is so troubling. Like, why would that, you know, why would you even think to use something so gruesome as the representative of what you believe in, you know?
Well, the other thing they dropped was in last season, right before the sacking of Winterfell, there's someone blowing a horn constantly, and Theon is like driven mad by this person blowing a horn all night. And then in this season, we saw Ramsay blowing the horn. So, like, I mean, that doesn't really help you as to who he is, but you know it's the same person who was at Winterfell who's torturing Theon, if you know what to look for.
Did not catch that as well.
Yeah, so...
All right, so we find out that after many episodes of incredibly painful torture, that it was Roose Bolton's bastard son, right?
Yes.
That was doing it, Ramsay?
Ramsay Snow.
And I got to say, Joanna Robinson, this was not worth it. I'm just going to state that flat out.
Yes.
It was not worth it on a number of levels. You could have compressed Theon's entire plotline into two episodes this season.
I agree. And if taken that time, you could have checked in with, you know, if they were going to bring his dad, if they were going to bring Balon Greyjoy and Yara Greyjoy back this season, maybe we could have checked in with them once this year rather than we haven't seen them all year. And then they like check back in with them like we're supposed to care, you know?
Yeah.
So I agree that Theon's plotline could have been condensed. There's an argument you can make for us needing to see over time the degradation of his mind and his character. But, you know, I don't think it would have hurt to condense his plot line. I do understand why they kept it a secret, because you wanted Roose Bolton's treachery to be a bit surprising. And so if you saw the sadistic lengths that his bastard was going to, you know, maybe you would begin to look askance at Roose Bolton.
I don't even think that's true. Like,
possibly.
Like,
possibly.
Okay.
That's why they kept it a secret.
Jonah, clearly the son is a psycho, right? Do you know what I mean? You feel like he's acting not on doctor's orders here. I mean, the fact that he freaking killed a bunch of his own men just to play this stupid funsies. Game on Theon.
For funsies. Yeah.
I'm actually more angry at this than I would. Like, okay, so the Talisa thing in last week, like, I talked down from a ledge. I'm actually more angry at this, not viscerally at this, but I'm more angry at this intellectually that this would happen on the show. That you would show a dude being tortured endlessly just to have this totally anticlimactic reveal. It just is like, why? You know, why did you make us endure that terribleness? It was not worth it. And
I agree. I think they bungled it.
Like, if you're going to show someone getting brutally tortured, you want to have a pretty good reason. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you can do this if you're Zero Dark 30. Do you know what I mean? You can do some of that. Like, if you have a point to make, fine. But if it's just like, the world is brutal. And, oh, and look at how sick this dude is, huh? He's sick.
No, but that's not the only point. I mean, I mean, I'm not going to talk too much about it. But, you know, Theon's not dead. So this is not the end of his plot line. So there's more to come, basically. Okay. So I don't think you can, like, make a final judgment, but I can agree with you, and you can say where we are now, we could have gotten there with fewer scenes with Theon.
Right.
Right. So.
All right. Well, let's take a break now to thank our sponsor for this week. We got to thank an author this week, Greg Kiser. That's Greg Kiser. He is one of the sponsors of our Kickstarter, John Robinson, and we should always say this podcast is only made possible with the generous donations of our Kickstarter backers. Thank you guys so much. So thanks to Greg this week for sponsoring this week's episode. Greg is the author of a book called Insight. That's I-N-S-Y-T-E, Insight. And this book is available right now on Amazon in paperback and an ebook. So you can go to Amazon and just search for Insight. That's I-N-S-Y-T-E. It's $1.99. And it is, I'm going to read from the back cover here, that it is a paranormal thriller that will appeal to readers of Thomas Harris and Stephen King. It's Tampa Bay in the year is 2020. Ex-Navy SEAL Mitch Downing discovers how to tap into the internet with his mind. His new insight provides transparent access to the sum of all human knowledge recorded since hieroglyphics. More than mere information, Mitch can see into men's hearts and be all places at all times. If knowledge is power, Mitch just became the strongest man in the world, your basic Google Glass on steroids. Let me ask you, Jonah Robinson, are you a fan of Thomas Harris and Stephen King, just out of curiosity?
I'm a huge Thomas Harris fan.
Really? Well, what are your favorite books with Thomas Harris?
Well, he wrote, like, you know, Hannibal and Silence of the Lambs and all this sort of stuff. I think, like, Red Dragon is maybe my favorite Thomas Harris. But yeah, I'm a huge Thomas Harris fan, and I love, of course, Stephen King's early stuff. Not some of his later stuff, not so much. But
Shawshank Redemption is pretty good.
But I mean, those are lofty folks to be compared to Thomas Harris and Stephen King. So not bad company, Greg Kiser.
Yeah, very good. So if you are interested in checking out Greg's book, go to Amazon.com and search for it. It's called Insight, I-N-S-Y-T-E. It's available in paperback and ebook format. Here is a quote by Susan Breen, who writes about Insight. You've got a great book here. Some of the scenes were so powerful, I could barely catch my breath. I love your characters and your imagination. So check this out. And you know what's awesome today is, like, people can, if they have a good idea and they have some time on their hands that they and they're sort of self-starters, they can put a book together and get it out on Amazon, and thousands upon thousands of people will download it. You know what I mean? Like self-published style. And so, like, kind of the democratization of literature is happening through delivery platforms like Kindle. So it's pretty cool. Check out Insight at Amazon.com. And again, thank you guys, everyone. Greg, author of Insight, I-N-S-Y-T-E at Amazon.com. And also all the people that donated to Kickstarter. This wouldn't have been possible without them. Am I right, Jonah Robinson?
Absolutely.
Pretty cool stuff. Pretty cool stuff. So anyway, let's move on. let's move on, Jonah Robinson, into the final few plot lines here.
So, right, so you wanted to talk about Sam, and I interrupted you earlier when you were talking about Sam.
Yeah,
and
so
Brand.
Sam emerges, right, and kind of bursts onto the scene, and it was I was like surprised because we so rarely see these characters intersect.
Right.
You know what I mean? Even last week, those scenes could have been shot totally separately, right?
Yes.
And at first, I thought the show was going to do something like incredibly dumb. Because Sam says, "Hey, who's your brother?" And I think it was Jojen Reed that was like, "It doesn't matter whose brother is." And I thought they were going to conceal that information from each other for a while.
Right.
Unfortunately, that didn't happen, and they just Sam uses his smarts, which are becoming more obvious every week, to say, "Hey, of course I know who you are. You're Jon Snow's brother, and I would recognize Hodor anywhere, even though of course he's never met Hodor before." But Jon was very vivid in his descriptions, apparently. And so that was enough.
There's a big guy who just says Hodor, so, you know, yeah. Look out for him. Yeah. And also the direwolf is a tip-off, so.
Right. Yeah, good point. So then they kind of have this back and forth. They go to Castle Black, and there's this kind of very amusing, you know, they're trying to convince Bran to join them.
Well, they're going to Castle Black, but they're at the Knight's Fort, and Bran wants to go north of the wall, and Gilly and Sam are like, no, we just came from there. We're not going back there.
And there's some confusion because there's a lot of confusion about where exactly they are at this point, right? So they are south of the wall, correct?
Well, the Knight's Fort, yeah, it's one of the castles on the wall.
Right, so they're moving along. They're moving sort of along the wall, right?
Like, well, Sam and Gilly go along, like they get to Castle Black
right.
later in the episode. So basically they come through the Knight's Fort because there's that sally port there where they can get through.
Right.
And then they go along to Castle Black.
And can we explain what the hell Bran is doing at this point? He's looking for the Three-Eyed Raven in his dreams.
Right? Yeah.
But do we as viewers of the show know anything about what it is that represents or what he's going to find, you know, like?
No, nor does he really.
Okay.
They're following these prophetic dreams.
So basically there's no stakes at all to this plotline, essentially. Other than the fact that
I mean, Jojen, like, it's proof of Jojen Reed's powers that he knew about the White Walkers and like everything that they had seen north of the wall. Sam's like, "You don't know what's out there." And Jojen's like, "Oh, is it this and that and this other thing that I dreamt?" And he's like, yeah, it is those things. So, you know, at least you know that Jojen's dreams have accuracy. But
sure.
Yeah, they're chasing a prophecy right now, basically.
Right. But there's, you know, there's just, and what is the prophecy? Do we know specifically what it is?
No.
Is Bran the chosen one that's supposed to bring balance to the Force? You know what I mean? Like, how can they expect you to care about this plotline unless you know anything about it? I just don't, you know, it's just hard for me to get invested. That's all.
It's hard. The dream stuff is hard to translate. And it's not even all that compelling in the book. So I'll give you that. But it was nice to see Sam. It's nice to see that Sam has more dragonglass knives.
Yeah, interesting. I don't remember seeing those, but whatever. Sure, he must have packed them away. That's cool. Because at first, when he handed it out, I thought, oh, maybe it didn't shatter last time. But nope, he just has a ton of it.
Yeah, maybe it was like swaddled up with a baby. I don't know.
Yeah.
But yeah, he had a bunch. So, and some arrowheads. So that's nice.
Yes, very convenient. and then Sam goes back to the Castle Black, right?
Yeah.
And finds the maester there. And they have this kind of slapstick scene where, you know, oh my gosh, the baby's not mine. And it was actually genuinely quite amusing. So
no, it was pretty cute.
Yeah.
And I liked his whole, like, reciting the Night's Watch vow back to Master Aemon and sort of saying, like, no, I know my vow, and this is what it is, and don't you feel like that's what I did? And it's true. And then he has, like, some nice self-deprecating humor about how he's a better, like, writer than he is a fighter, and then he sends a bunch of ravens, so.
Jonah, it's pronounced maester. I just want to say that.
Master?
Nice. Maester. It's maester.
Oh, maester.
We go to Dragonstone. So later on, right, I get all the plot lines are converging again. It's kind of cool, right?
Right.
So let's just go straight to later on when Jon Snow is kind of washing his face and Ygritte shows up. Now, mm-hmm. What was the red-haired dude that was with her at the time?
Tormund.
Yeah, so Dormund, you said?
Tormund.
Tormund. So I guess he just kind of let her track him down.
I think he took a nap or something.
Yeah, he's just she's like, I'm going to go track down Jon Snow. And he's like, okay, I trust you completely.
You go, girl.
Yeah. Nothing could go wrong with this plan.
You take my horse. You go.
So she tracks him down, and they have this great scene where she says to him, she says the you know nothing Jon Snow line, but it is in a much different context this time.
Ygritte, you know I didn't have a choice. You always knew who I was. What I am. I have to go home now. I know you won't hurt me.
You know nothing, Jon Snow.
I do know some things. I know I love you. I know you love me. I have to go home now.
Mm-hmm.
And I love it when a show does that, when it gives you a line of dialogue that you've seen before but uses it in a much different context, because it's always been playful before, but now it's like, you're probably going to die. And when she shoots him, I actually thought he was a goner, right? I thought, oh my gosh, another shocker. Jon Snow gets killed this episode.
Yay! No. Aww.
But it was not to be. It was not to be. Now, so, you know, I think one question, Alan Sepinwall, I believe, brought this up, was did she miss on purpose? Because she, you know what a master marksman she is.
And like, people can correct me on this, but because people were saying this last week. Okay, so when John flees the fight, you know, when he gets on the horse and he rides away from the wildlings and Ygritte's very pissed off, a bunch of people were like, I'm super pissed she didn't shoot him because she's supposed to shoot him. And my memory reading the book, and please write in if I'm wrong, is that he finds an arrow in his, like, he rides away, and it's not until later that he discovers there's an arrow in his leg. He doesn't get, like, riddled with arrows. There's an arrow in his leg, and he pulls it out, and he looks at the feathers on it, and it's, she uses Grey Goose feathers, I think, to fletch her arrows, and he notices that it's not her feathers. He's like, oh, good, it wasn't her arrow. Like, she didn't shoot me. So maybe I read that completely wrong, and she did, because everyone seems to think it was her. But anyway, she did get some arrows in him. Rose Leslie did a good job in that scene, but that scene was awkward and stupid. And I don't know why they didn't just do it at the end of the fight last week rather than have this thing later.
Why did you think it was awkward and stupid? Because I thought it was awkward and stupid because it was almost comical how many arrows he got in him.
I thought it was like, I love you. I know you love me. I don't know. Maybe it's Kit Harington's fault.
I actually was quite moved by that.
But you like them so much more than I do.
He was playing the only cards he had left.
That's true.
And he's saying, you know, I love you. I know you love me. You're not going to hurt me. But then she freaking shoots him full of arrows. Like, that's just looks silly to have a guy have that many arrows in him and not be dead. I know it happened with Rob last week, but that first arrow looked like it went through his heart, man. So
he's wearing a lot of layers. We'll see.
Then he gets picked up later by Sam. And, dude, I couldn't help but cringe multiple times when he, like, fell on his back with the arrows in him.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I did too.
That looked rough.
Oh, it did.
So, wow, Jon Snow has been on an adventure, and he now knows what Mance Rayder's plan is. Although, geez, dude, we did not see enough of Kieran Hines this season, huh?
Mm-hmm.
It's totally gone. Mm. Speaking of people who were not in this episode, Marjorie did not show up either. That was kind of disappointing. I really liked her. So,
yeah, she's great. Yeah. That was another theme that I noticed upon my, like, third rewatch today was, like, the homecoming theme.
Yep.
Because you had John coming home, you had Jamie coming home, you know, and it just, they seem to be trying really hard to draw some parallels. So whether or not it was effective, I don't know, but that was one of them.
So a couple more plot lines here. Davos had a nice heart-to-heart with Gendry this episode.
Yes.
Just getting to know him. And that was very, very nice. You know, you get a better sense of who Davos is.
Yeah.
And boy, does that guy learn how to read really quickly. very impressive. And they had this nice little chat. And by the way, that ability to read really came in handy at the end there.
Just in the nick of time, man.
Just in the nick of time. So they have a conversation. And can you explain exactly what it is that Melisandre is saying? Like, why is it that Gendry needs to die?
She needs the blood of the, you know, the Baratheon blood or the, you know, long ago Targaryen blood. In It's different in the book, so I can't speak too accurately, but it just seems like she needs his royal blood, and she needs a lot of it. She needs all of it. She wants to kill him.
She can't just use penis blood
for
all of her leeches. She needs to use the whole thing.
Penis leeches just won't do sometimes.
That's right.
But yeah.
And we should point out, a lot of people have emailed in and said, yeah, Stannis threw three leeches into the fire, right?
Yeah.
And they were, I believe, Joffrey, Rob, and who is the third?
Balon Greyjoy.
Balon Greyjoy, right? When really he should have thrown in Daenerys in there, but whatever. She's, I think, the much bigger danger.
Dark Horse. You need a bigger leech for Dany.
That's right.
I think.
That's right. if you know what I'm saying. It's pointed out that they threw Robb Stark in there and Robb died. So maybe those other people are doomed as well, perhaps. We'll see. Anyway, they have this scene where, interestingly framed, where Melisandre is kind of the devil and Davos is the angel over
blatantly
Stannis'
framed.
Shoulder.
Yes. Pretty, I thought that pretty, was really, yeah.
Pretty over the top, but then this episode did a lot of over the top things.
Yeah, we'll get there. But I don't really like this. I don't like this Stannis as much as I like the book Stannis, because I think they are relying too much on this devil angel thing, where I think Stannis in the book was just a better guy. Like, he had a better moral compass than this Stannis does. This Stannis just seems to be adrift and like listening to one and then listening to the other and then listening to the one, you know, whereas the Stannis in the book, I feel like had scruples. More scruples. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So, mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so what exactly happens at the end here, right? Davos says, you're going to need me because Castle Black has given him this report, right, that we just saw the maester right before. So can you explain the dynamics exactly here?
Well, you know, I think it's supposed to be kind of intentionally oblique, but basically Melisandre was like, the War of Five Kings is nothing. This is the real war. This is where we need to turn our attention. And we're going to need every man we got, basically.
That's
what saves his life.
One of the issues with this show is that you don't really get a good sense of what it is that, like, how each episode progresses, right? At the end of season two, you saw this huge mass of White Walkers, right? And so you think, oh my gosh, what's going to happen with these White Walkers? We're clearly going to see this develop in season three. Basically, like, it's not ignored, but you know what I mean? It's just more prepping for the White Walkers.
Right.
And so...
Well, I mean, that was more about, like, then they wiped out much of the Night's Watch, you know? There was that battle at the Fist of the First Men, and most of the Night's Watch was – a lot of the Night's Watch was decimated. So, it's not like they just showed up and then just wandered away. They showed up and they killed a lot of really important people. And then this threat is – the threat is even more dire than it was before, because the people that were supposed to defend Westeros from the White Walkers are dead. Their leader is dead. You know, so it's like, this is why we need to turn our attention to the wall, is like the sentinels there have fallen, you know?